What's up, guys? It's Nick from the Epic Film Guys here, and I hope you marked those calendars. September the 14th will be our first show back, episode 109, our review of the new adaptation of Stephen King's It. And Justin and Lois already got the chance to see the film in Washington, D.C. this week, so I am sure they are more than excited to get on and talk about it. Tonight, our last piece from the live stream for The Cure, and this is going to be all about that spotlight. And if you're a member of the Hobster's Dumpster over on Facebook, check that link in the show notes, then you know we're going to be doing spotlight literally, I don't know, a couple times a month or at least once a month, where I'm going to watch films that I've never seen before, give them reviews, and we're going to pop all those films in there. We're going to throw those out as mini-sodes, some of them even as patron-exclusive stuff over on Podbean. So, hey, get over to patron.podbean.com/epicfilmguys and throw us some support. In the meantime, though, enjoy this. We did Cloud Atlas, we did Sideways, we did The Untouchables, and we did The Departed. And we were joined by John from the Now in Technicolor podcast, and JD joined us for Sideways and The Untouchables. He is, of course, from the In Session Film podcast, and Fuzzy D was on with us for Cloud Atlas and The Departed. So please, please enjoy, and we will see you guys again really, really soon for some brand new episodes. We're going to go ahead. Fuzzy, we got you back? Yep, Fuzzy's back.
Yeah, man.
We got Fuzzy back. All right, so first thing I'm going to do is I'm just going to pull this up in the stream here, and we're going to play a little bit of this, and then we're going to get into our talk. First film up for Epic Film Guys Spotlight is going to be The Departed.
When I was your age, they would say we could become cops or criminals. What I'm saying is this. When you're facing a loaded gun, difference.
This is not the regular police. This is the state police.
We are an elite unit.
This is who we're after.
Frank Costello.
You won't be paid as a regular cop, but there's a bonus involved.
So what do I do?
You will not ever know the identity of undercover people.
You have anyone in with Costello presently?
Maybe.
Do you know who I am?
Maybe not.
I'm gonna have my associates search you.
That was quick. You think he's dead already?
Get your hands off me!
I think we could work something out.
We are all convinced that Costello has at least one mole inside the special investigation.
All right, so let's go ahead and open up the discussion. Since you are our guest, Fuzzy, for Spotlight, we will start with you for your thoughts, just kind of overall on The Departed. How many times have you seen it? How much do you love it? Do you hate it? Is it a piece of shit? Can Scorsese go fuck off and die? Don't say those kind of things. That's mean.
I won't say them about this particular movie about Scorsese, but no, this fucking movie, I love this movie so hard. It is one of those ones that I've bought like several times, had it on on DVD. I've had two Blu-rays of it. I love it to death. So many good roles in this. Fucking Marky Mark has to be the best in this whole thing, though.
I would agree with that 100%.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely.
I love him in this movie.
he's a baller. So yeah, he's balling hard. But like it's great. Everyone suits it well. Baldwin's a boss too.
Whoops.
That's right.
It's one of my. It's one of my pet peeves with this film. I didn't mean to cut you off there, but one of my pet peeves with this film is just,
oh, fucking hell, every 2 minutes.
It's literally like it only is in the beginning of the movie, thank God. It's only in the beginning of the movie, but Jesus Christ, like, it's so like loud and obnoxiously blaring. And I know some people like dig on the Dropkick Murphys a lot. I think they're fine, but like I did not want it to be like, I'm like, oh my God. Good Lord.
It seems to suit the movie to a T, though.
It definitely does suit the movie, yeah. Definitely does suit the movie.
And how fucking good's Jack Nicholson in this movie as well? Like, that guy is fucking amazing, right?
He gets a lot of shit, actually, for this movie because his Boston accent just kind of goes in and out in the movie. But yeah. I think he's really, really great in the role. And, like, I mean, his accent's kind of, sometimes it's there more, sometimes it's not there. But I still think he does fantastic in it. He's a menacing, menacing guy.
I think it's probably his best performance he's done since then. That's my opinion, though. I love him in the movie. He is menacing. He's definitely got that villainous swagger to him, but he's still likable, and you still seem to care about him a little bit. I mean, obviously, him being Jack Nicholson adds to that, but he definitely is as brutal as he's supposed to be in the film.
And apparently, the sound clips are playing really quietly over in the chat. I do apologize. I will try to get that ironed out. I think the trailer was quiet because of the actual volume in the media player was turned down, so I do apologize for that. But yeah, I'll keep working on it, guys. I do apologize if you can't hear anything. As long as you can hear the Dropkick Murphys, I suppose. It's...
Perfect.
Oh my god! I added that to the soundboard just so I could obnoxiously play it a few times during this review. Oh my good lord! Yeah, we'll start at the top. I mean, basically, your plot synopsis is there's a mole within the Boston State Police, the Special Investigations Unit, and you know, that's Costello's mole, who's Jack Nicholson, and then simultaneously they have a mole, Leonardo DiCaprio, in with Costello's crew, and basically it's just kind of this amazing tense cat and mouse game the whole film, as you kind of try to wonder, oh, is he going to find out who the mole is here? Is he going to find out who the mole is here? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think Scorsese does a masterful job in this movie of just keeping you on the edge of your seat in terms of, are they going to find out? When are they going to find out? What's going to happen in the film? I think it's absolutely fantastic. And I mean, even though you know who both moles are, like, pretty much from the get-go of the movie, I think that that works really, really well because the audience knows what the characters don't. And even with that bent to it, like, that could have worked against the movie's favor, but Scorsese just has the tension so ratcheted up, it's just absolutely perfect.
I mean, make no mistake on the quality of this movie. Not only was it successful commercially, I'm not sure if you recall, Nick, this baby won 4 Oscars at the 79th Academy Awards. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Film Editing. According to information on the internet, the interwebs, this film was loosely based on Whitey Bulger and the corrupt FBI agent John Connolly, who we just saw a film about with Black Mass last year, which wasn't anywhere near as good as this movie, though I feel it definitely did try to take a few tabs from that movie and put it in this. But it definitely shows with, you know, what was going on in Boston at the time when this film was made, with the way that the gangland was... God damn it.
Literally every time in the movie, like I said, luckily he stops it early on. But yeah, I didn't mean to derail you there, Justin. But yeah, I absolutely agree. It's and of course this is also based on, I think it's a Hong Kong film called Infernal Affairs or Internal Affairs, something like that.
Yeah, Infernal Affairs is fucking awesome too. Really good. I'd highly recommend anyone who likes foreign language films, check out Infernal Affairs. It's it does this pretty much at the same level. So exactly the same storyline as far as this goes, just no Boston accents.
So let's start on with actors, part of the cast outside of Nicholson. Leonardo DiCaprio in this film. This was not the first time he had worked with Scorsese. He plays William Costigan Jr. What do you guys think overall for Leo's performance in the film?
Yeah, big round of applause. He was probably it was him and Damon as the two sort of contrasting leads in this, and I thought he was much, much better. He just suits it well. He's going through this whole sort of mental breakdown of being undercover for such a long time and just out in the cold, and I love it. He just slowly devolves, and that scene when they're in the building at the end and there's the mm-hmm. mole hunt and he thinks he's getting out, and then spoiler alert, he gets shot in the head. Oh my god, no one saw it coming. It was just like, yeah.
I definitely remember being shocked when I saw that movie in theaters and that happened. I never expected once to see pretty much everyone get offed at the end of this movie. It's not in a nihilistic or cynical way, in my opinion. It's just that's the world. That's the way that world works, and that's the way it is.
That's what's so great about it too, is because you get to the end of it where, you know, it's kind of leading you in the direction like, yeah, this is going to be somewhat of a happy ending. And then, you know, boom, all of a sudden the elevator door opens, he gets capped. And then, you know, he plays Chase in season 3, James Badgedale, that's the guy's name. He was the second mole in there, and he lets Matt Damon free. And of course, Matt Damon, as soon as he gets his hands free, picks up a gun and shoots him right in the head, and also kills Anthony Anderson's character, which it's so fantastic. It's I absolutely love it. It's such a great story, and it does still, of course, have that happy ending where, you know, Matt Damon, he's the hero, he's being celebrated, he's the one that found everybody out, he gets to wrap the whole thing on James Badgedale, and then he buys some groceries, he's headed back to his apartment, and then you just see Marky Mark standing there in that goddamn tracksuit with like the little cloth baggies over his shoes and rubber gloves on his head, pops him right in the head. Oh man, so great. So great, because it's like Fuzzy mentioned there when we were, you know, still getting into it. Marky Mark, I would agree 100%. He's absolutely the best thing about this film.
He is the standout.
Yeah, he is fantastic in it.
And he's not in it that much. He's like, there's only a small amount of scenes that he's in, but every time he's on screen, man,
he's so on point.
Yeah, he just sucks up like every ounce of your attention, and you're like, yeah, I want him to say something else. Say something nasty. It's so cool.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And for whatever reason, the live stream, the chat wasn't refreshing on the live stream, so I do apologize for that as well. Maybe we'll just drop this in here. There we go. This, if I have one complaint about this film, it is how obnoxiously often it cuts into that song during the opening part of the film. Like I said, but
you know, fortunately, he does stop. I've ever heard. You're the first person I've ever heard, honestly, Nick, ever complain about that.
You know,
ever,
the crappy thing, the thing that I hate about that song too, is it's just like the same verse repeated over and over again. It's like, yeah, I've lost my leg or whatever. Like, oh my God, just shut the hell up. But like,
I think it's just from all my times hanging out in the punk rock crowd for so many years. I just heard that song so many fucking times at the bar and the shows. It was played constantly. It's just, I don't know. I kind of seem to forget about it. You just kind of get so used to it. But I get what you mean. Though,
I'm just not the Dropkick Murphys fan that a lot of people out there are.
Hey, I like them, but I mean,
I like them too. But like, I mean, after like the third or fourth time. Yeah, right. After like the third or fourth time in the movie where all of a sudden like there's a jarring scene transition and it's just blaring at you like, bang, 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 and I'm like, oh my God. Mm.
Hey, well, look, I am just thankful that we finally got a Scorsese movie.
Puzzy?
Where'd you go, man?
Yeah, his audio just completely died. I didn't know if that was you as well that had that experience, Justin.
Yep, he's not there.
Steve from Everything I Love from the Movies, or Learned from the Movies, excuse me, is at the Sierra Nevada Torpedo Room in Berkeley and has 12 beers in front of him right now. You son of a bitch. God damn, I've got a couple of beers chilling, waiting for me for a little bit later. I cannot wait.
I gotta wait, man. If I started in now, I'd be sleeping in the next 2 hours. So.
Yeah, right? No, that's why I put What Are You Drinking until way, way later in the evening. Even though, like I said, I will have a glass of bourbon with David and Juliet when they get on around 5. But, yeah, oh, man, I don't even know. But Fuzzy, we love you, and hopefully you get your audio issues sorted out soon. But in terms of anybody else in the cast, Justin, anybody else that you just love in this thing?
I think collectively the cast is good. You know, Matt Damon being one of the weaker links, I still enjoy him in the film. Martin Sheen is still good as well, even though he plays a small part as the captain. But
he plays a good counterpoint to Marky Mark's character, which is what he needs to do, and that's why I love him in it.
Exactly. And, you know, I also like Alec Baldwin as the captain in the film as well, even though, again, it's another small role. But when you go into this movie, you know, I remember when I first saw it in the theater, you were going into this knowing that it was a gangster by Martin Scorsese, and you saw those trailers, you knew the cast, so you kind of were really expecting a really good movie. And it was one of those times where I walked out feeling that I did see a really great movie, and I remember being really excited when it came out on DVD before Blu-ray was a thing, and buying that, and then rebuying the Blu-ray. And it's one of those that, you know, everyone holds up Goodfellas is like his big accomplishment, which I agree with. And I also love Casino. I love Taxi Driver. I love Raging Bull. I love all of his great classic movies. But, you know, this movie is a movie that came out at a time where I think people were thirsty for this kind of movie. And it definitely, it fills that void. And I hold it up personally right up next to those other ones, because of the fantastic performances, because of the cast, and because Scorsese directed it masterfully. I mean, it's just so well put together. Never am I bored at one point. The pacing is perfect, and all the characters are interesting to me. And the one thing that it gets right, Nick, and I'm going to use this word because it's the best way to describe this movie, is it's genuine to the subject matter that it's based upon. Yep, it feels so real. Yep. So many of these movies, you know, even Black Mass, for example, I didn't hate it. I enjoyed a lot about it, especially Johnny Depp's performance, but a lot of it just felt too Hollywood, too cinematic,
too sanitized. Much
the typical gangster tropes that we're so used to. It just followed those lines and it just stuck right to it. This movie kind of did its own thing with these characters. And I think a lot of it boils down to Leo's realistic portrayal of his character, the way that he performed as this character. You could totally relate to this guy. He's literally miserable. He hates the situation he's in. You could totally relate to everything he's going through. He's got personal problems on the side of this. He's trying to have a relationship as well. Well, if you want to call it a relationship, but I think all of those things, that's what make this movie so important and in modern time as well. This movie could have felt dated, but it felt really in line with what was going on in modern times at that point.
I think we have Fuzzy back. Fuzzy, you back?
I'm back.
All right. Sorry Yay. About that. But yeah, just to wrap up discussion on this really quickly, because we're behind on time here. But I think it's an absolutely fantastic film. This is one of the prime examples that I really do think you can point to. If you want to talk about the Academy awarding films for being due, or awarding filmmakers for being due, not that this is not a fantastic film. I think it's absolutely incredible. But, you know, if you want to sit and you want to just argue Scorsese's body of work, the other stuff he was nominated for versus this film,
yeah, I get
then
that.
It becomes a little bit more difficult to discuss back and forth. Fuzzy, I want to just leave it with you if you just have any final thoughts on The Departed before we move on to Cloud Atlas.
Like I was going to say before, I'm just happy that he didn't use Gimme Shelter in the soundtrack this time around. God. So the first time that he hasn't used that song in a movie, I think. So it's pretty awesome.
He had to do it one last time.
But that is, I mean, if you haven't seen The Departed is an absolutely fantastic movie. And like everybody here is saying, it's absolutely, it's just a spectacular film. It really, really is.
Are you out of control?
Yes. Wildly. Wildly out of control.
Are you the man behind the mask?
I fucking hate you. Is this what tonight's show is going to be like?
I'm the man behind the mask.
I'm the man behind the mask.
And I'm out of control. Man behind the mask. He's the man behind the mask. And he's out of control. I'm the man behind the mask. I'm the man behind the mask. And I'm out of control. And he's out of control.
This week in epic film history.
I do hate Patrick Swayze because it's like watching a fucking 2x4 act on screen so with a giant mullet.
Don't forget, ladies and gentlemen, we talked about that Dustin Diamond situation. I'm trying my best to get Dustin Diamond on the show. I'm definitely not kidding about this, so be on the lookout. It might
what
be
Justin
6 months
means
from
is
now.
He poured a pack of Splenda out in front of his apartment, and he expects to open his door in the morning and find Dustin Diamond lying on the welcome mat, licking it off.
We'll
and
see. I'm working on it.
Then he's just
going to
lull
him inside
and strap a microphone to his face.
The problem will be, if we get him on the show, he's not going to want to talk about being Screech at all, so I don't know what I'm going to talk to him about.
Listen,
you want to talk about prison
Saved
or...
By the Bell. We can talk about how much we hate Saved by the Bell.
No, all I love Saved by the Bell. I love Saved by the
Listen,
Bell.
Well, you know what? I'm
going to
kick
ever.
You off the show for that segment, and it'll just be me and Screech bashing the shit out of one of your most beloved shows of all time.
As long as you play the Zack Attack song in the background, that's all that matters.
I have no idea what that is, and I don't want to know. You know how much hate I'm going to get on Twitter for that right there? People are going to be sending me YouTube links and being like, fuck you, I hate you.
Not only do you not watch any movies, Nick, but you don't know Zack Attack, bro. Saved by the Bell.
I unfortunately most certainly do not. But we're going to move on now to a film that I don't think Fuzzy is as fond about or fond of as I am. And that is from the Wachowski siblings and Tom Tykwer. And this is Cloud Atlas, based on the novel by David Mitchell. So I'll go ahead and spin the trailer for that here.
Friday the 15th, we made sail with the morning tide. I had been quarantined to a storeroom away from the other passengers and crew. All I want to do now is return home.
My dear Sixsmith, I am in desperate need of your help. I got hooked on a journal written in 1849 by a dying lawyer during a voyage from a Pacific Isle to San Francisco. Half the book is missing. It's completely killing me. A half-finished book is, after all, a half-finished love affair.
What are you reading?
Old letters.
Why do you keep reading them?
I don't know. I was trying to understand why we keep making the same mistakes over and over.
Our lives and our choices, each encounter.
Luisa Rey, Spyglass Magazine.
Right. Suggests a new potential direction.
That's it. The music from my dream.
I call it the Cloud Atlas Sextet.
At home.
Movements I wrote imagining us meeting again and again in different lives, in different ages.
What are you doing in here?
We cross and recross our old tracks like figure skaters. The love of my life.
All right, now, if no one is familiar with the novel that this is based on, essentially, it opens with the story of the lawyer at sea in the 1850s or so. And, you know, it then tells half of that story, and then it skips forward to half of Robert Frobisher's story, who is the amanuensis for the composer. Then it skips half of that story, and then it goes to Luisa Rey, half of that story, and then it goes to the publisher. And Tom Hanks's Dermot Hoggins in this movie is absolutely amazing. I absolutely love him. And then from there, goes to this actually right here on the live stream. This is from SOMI451. This is a futuristic story about a corporate society. And then from there, in the middle of the novel, it tells the entire, like, after the end of the world kind of story with Tom Hanks as this goat farmer and Halle Berry is this really futuristic person. And then the novel goes backwards chronologically through the story, so you end up back at the lawyer on the ship in 1851. And then what the Wachowskis and Tom Tykwer decided to do was they took the film, the novel, and they deconstructed it. And what they decided to do, the key theme of the novel is this shooting star birthmark that every main character in each story has. But what they instead did is they took each of these characters and they put the same actor in different roles, which you see if you see in the trailer here, and it just kind of played them off of one another thematically. There's Tom Hanks' Dermot Hoggins. Literally, there's no part of this movie that's greater than a bald Tom Hanks that's like, fuck it, and he throws a dude off the roof of a fucking building. I'll just open this up. I absolutely love this film. I think it's absolutely beautiful. It's not perfect. It definitely is not. But I think in what it tried to do and what they were able to do in terms of the way they tie these characters together thematically, and especially skipping between all these time frames, these characters that aren't really connected but are in terms of destiny and things like that, I absolutely love it. I think it's fascinating. But Fuzzy, I think, has a little bit of a different take. I believe.
Hey, look, I had only seen this once before this last week. And yeah, it was the first time I saw it. It was jarring. It was confronting. I didn't know what to expect. Like, you're just looking at something, and then all of a sudden it cuts away. It's a different scene. And it cuts away 2 seconds later, and it's quite confronting. It's really hard to keep up with the story. Like, if you're not expecting it, I think. So you have to really go in prepared for something, and you're sitting down. It's nearly 3 hours long.
It is about 2 hours and 50 minutes, I believe. Yeah,
very long.
And
yeah.
That is. that is a long time to sit there and have like intense focus for the entire time. Yeah. So I kind of think that that's where it lost it for me, because it's just like, it's just, yeah, you don't have time to ease into a story because you're already shifting onto something else. And I don't know, it's such a big, like, it took me two takes this week to watch it, even the second time around. So, you know, it's just a lot to digest as part of an enjoyable movie. Yeah, but there are all of the pieces to it are great. And I would actually like to see each of those as individual movies, because I think they would be quite amazing on their own, especially that the futuristic, what is it, Neo Soul?
Yeah.
Which is clearly like Wachowski's going like AWOL. I love that. It was really cool.
Yeah, so the way that Yeah, the way that it broke down in terms of directing duties, the Wachowskis did the 1850s, the guy on the boat, and they did the two futuristic sections. So they did Neo Soul and they did the Big Island, quote, After the Fall. It's like 23 something, like, is the year in that. And then Tom Tykwer did the 1930s, the 1970s, and the present day. That's the way the directing duties broke down. I mean, they worked very closely together throughout pre-production and throughout post-production on the film, but those are the way the individual segments broke. So you're absolutely correct. That, especially the Neo Soul stuff, it's definitely very the most Wachowski-ish, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I would say so, for sure.
Justin, I haven't heard from you on this yet, and I can't remember if you loved this movie or not, or if you even liked this movie or not.
No, I definitely like it. I own it. We've had this talk many times. Since then, I have watched it one more time and didn't walk away as enthused. However, the one thing that I give this thing as many points as I do for is ambition, because, man, when you watch this thing, you just got to think and realize on paper how hard this would have must have been for them to sit down and be like, okay, we're going to take this on. And they actually did it. And they did a pretty good job. I think mostly what people criticize it for is the fact that it took so much on and tried to jam pack it all in one movie. And it doesn't all work. I think it's a very interesting watch. I always get very intrigued every time I'm watching it. But I do agree with Fuzzy that it is kind of hard to follow at times. I find myself getting confused and just my brain just getting tired and wanting to shut off halfway through it. Then I just have to continue to try to focus on this thing. It is a chore, to say the least. But the one thing that I love about it, outside of its ambition, is its visual aesthetic. I am a guy that loves when a film is so well shot. There's some wide shots, even if, as you could see in that trailer there, it's just a beautiful looking movie. And it's very well acted, too. I just think that it gets caught too much up in its ambition to really follow through with that ambition and give us and deliver us a cohesive film. It's got great parts. It's got great elements. And I do enjoy watching it for the most part, but it is way too long. And I can agree with you also, Fuzzy, that it'd be interesting to see this maybe cut in half, maybe if they did a second film.
Or like they actually did with the book, like where they, right, you know, you did a full story and then you moved on. You did the first half and then like came back to it later. I think like the way they chopped it up, that must have been an absolute fucking nightmare to edit, by the way.
And I think
it's just hacked up to pieces. So yeah,
the thing about it, and I actually had this discussion with Wes from the Via VHS podcast as well, because I've read the novel, and I don't know if either one of you have read the novel, but the novel is a tough read as well, because it starts out with that 1851, and Mitchell actually switches up the way he does his language, and he switches up his prose between the different segments. So the 1851 segment's got more of kind of an old-timey novel feel to it and whatnot, and it's written in sense of being a journal. And then it switches to the 1930s segment, and the stream must have hiccuped, but according to this, we're still up. So just let me know if that's still having trouble in a minute. And then it skips from there, and then it goes to basically letter writing in the 1930s, so it gets a little bit easier. And then, can anybody hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. I can hear you.
Okay, so I don't know. Yeah. The stream, I guess, is just kind of hiccuping or whatever. But then from there, you get to the 1970s, which is a very, very easy read. It kind of plays out like a mystery novel. And then you get to the 2012 segment with Cavendish, the publisher, and it plays out like kind of a comedic thing. It's really funny. And then it starts to get harder again when you get to the the Neo Soul segment, because then it starts to change up language again, make it more futuristic. And the middle segment in it is incredibly difficult to read through, because the language is, he invents this whole kind of language where they speak, and the guys in the live chat are having fun with the true and all the this stuff. Like,
yeah,
that. The language in it, it's not nearly as bad in the movie as it is in the novel, but I would still love to see a cut of the movie that's done like the novel. But the novel, when you guys mentioned frustrations with it kind of cutting all over the place, the novel does that as well, where it's literally at the middle of the segment, and in a couple of them it's in mid-sentence, it stops and goes to the next story. So it's very jarring as well. But I think that that's kind of the intended effect, both with the film and with the novel. It's meant to be jarring because you're not meant to really focus on those kind of minutiae like that. It really wants to be a bigger themes and a bigger ideas story, either in both. And I just think, in terms of ambition, Justin mentioned that with the way that they took the novel and they cut it up, and then they, you know, they just interspersed all the different timelines together, so they're telling all the different stories at once.
The scope on this thing is so huge. Yeah. It's just thinking about it, dude, makes me like nervous. You know what I mean? And that's what I was going to get to. The next point that I had was, there was no way that they were ever going to be able to market this thing. And I'm not sure if you recall or not, Nick, they didn't market it very well, if at all, because
I heard nothing about it until it was already out at the movies. So the trailer, like, it was just awesome, one of those things. I was at the movies. It was there.
You're absolutely right in terms of the marketing. They released that one like 6-minute trailer, which is the one that I've got playing in the live stream right now. And then that's what really actually I was so fascinated by. That's what prompted me to go out and buy and read the book. And I absolutely loved it, but I can definitely understand when people are like, you know, kind of disconnected from it, because it's so much to take in. It really demands, I think, 3 viewings or 4 viewings, because you really want to focus on 1 or 2 of the stories as you watch through. And then after you've watched it through a couple times, you start kind of connecting everything. You know,
but how do you sell that to people? Like, oh yeah, our movie's great, but you got to watch it like 4 or 5 times before you actually understand it. Like, it's hard to get involved with that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can't. I mean, there's just nothing else you can do. There's really not.
Modern viewers don't even want to have to think for themselves in movies anymore. That's why so many of these modern huge movies we see hit theaters every year are so literal. Everything is just spoon fed to the audience, and that's something that frustrates both Nick and I on many.
And see if this will kind of course correct here. I do apologize, everyone.
Hold tight, guys.
Yeah, well, hold tight to you and Fuzzy, because you're the only ones that can hear me right now, at least until the stream gets back up and cooking.
There we go.
Are we back up now?
Looks like he's back.
All right.
I see you.
I know that YouTube has a limit on like how long you can stream for, but I was pretty sure that limit, I had been reading before that it was like 8 hours. So maybe we just hit that limit way earlier. Maybe it's not nearly as long as I thought it was. But yeah,
that's quality control, man.
Yeah,
quality control shut you down.
Yeah, I don't know, but like I said, we're back. So maybe I'll just have to schedule a couple extra streams.
We're
resets.
Back. We're the man behind the mask, right. And we're out of control.
All right. So basically, we'll wrap up discussion here about Cloud Atlas. If anybody else has anything else they want to add about it, like I said, I absolutely love it. It's probably because I love the novel so much, and because I love the ambition of it more, that I'm kinder to it than some people are. But you know, it definitely had that polarizing result when it came out as well. Some people, like Roger Ebert, gave it 4 out of 4 stars, but other people utterly despised it,
hated it, and called it the worst
movie of the year. So I mean, it's definitely one of those films that's super polarizing in terms of that. So, and yeah, thank you, everybody.
I'll go back to what Justin was saying earlier about the how it looked, and the makeup in this movie is fucking incredible.
It is.
Like how they set everybody up. And that one of the favorite scenes for me is that last is the credits trailer at the end, where they're going through all of the different roles that the characters are playing, and you can't pick them all. There's absolutely no way that you can pick all of the characters that these people played. So,
yeah, when I first watched the movie and saw that at the end of the movie, I was actually surprised, because I was like, holy shit, that was that person. Like you just don't realize how many, because some of them are such bit little parts too, that you only barely see them, but it's great. Yeah, I love it.
It's a bit of a cheat, but
it is.
And And Hugh Grant in this movie was pretty phenomenal. As when he was Jim Broadbent's older brother.
Oh, yeah.
it absolutely incredible. Like, he just, like, looked, like, you couldn't tell it was him at all. And he was just, I loved it. Loved him. The way this movie looks, and how they did that, how they pulled that off,
and how it sounds too. I really like the score to this film too. I very much appreciate it. I remember after the film came out, I downloaded it just to kind of live in that world a little bit, because it definitely takes you to a different place when you listen to it, and it's one of those types of scores that really, they really do just invest you in a different place, and I really appreciate that as well.
All right. Well, I think we will wrap up discussion on Cloud Atlas. Now, for our epic preview segment, I'm going to make this a little bit more freeform, and it's going to be a little bit more condensed. I'm going to try to wrap this up by 4 o'clock so we can make sure we get on to our everybody. Yeah, oh, man, if they were in here, they'd kill me. The everyone has a podcast segment. Adam and Brian are going to be on just bullshitting with us for that segment, which I can't wait for. So essentially, we're going to wrap over into our epic preview segments here. Fuzzy D, thank you very, very much for joining us for both movie soundtrack trivia, which you did dismally at.
That was fucking awful. Guys,
A for effort.
You definitely get an A for effort. Very big A for effort. If you want to hang out with us and discuss any of these trailers, feel free, but I'm not going to stop playing them just so there's not going to be any discussion in between when we're actually playing the trailers. So if anybody wants to jump in on Discord and discuss these trailers with us as we go through them, feel free, even though you guys can't see them at the same time that I am, so that's kind of a cheat, but whatever. All right, but we'll go ahead and wrap through this here. Thank you very much, everybody, and please share the link. Please help get the word out. I saw Juliet Miranda jumped into the chat. Thank you very much for sharing the link, Julia. I definitely appreciate it, and for your donation earlier today. We're at about 30% of our goal, 31%, somewhere around there. So we got a little bit of ways to push here as we get further into the afternoon. Thank you very, very much, everybody. And with the show.
Hey, this is Paul.
And Wayne.
From the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews podcast.
And these are the 10 reasons you're listening to the Epic Film Guys Real Rundown podcast.
10, Justin.
9, Nick.
8, Film News.
7, Passionate Reviews.
6, Beer.
5, Nick's Rants.
4, Justin's Hobo Beard.
3, Entertaining Banter.
2, It's a Star Wars Circle Jerk.
Number 1, Nick is Seth Rogen's doppelganger.
So there you go.
Epic Film Guys Real Rundown podcast.
Get involved.
Hey, James, do you want to watch a movie?
Okay, Emily, what should we watch?
Maybe we should watch something to help us prepare for our next episode of the Classy Little Podcast.
Well, what's in theaters?
Oh, I actually know the answer to this because I listened to the Epic Film Guys podcast.
Oh, I love those guys. The Epic Previews, What You Drinking segment, Nick Justin.
Justin's Lisp, Nick's Rants.
No, let's skip the movie and just binge listen to their show.
Oh, good idea. I'll get the popcorn and beer.
Nice. Do you know if they ever reviewed my favorite movie ever made, Kazam, starring Shaquille O'Neal, his masterful and subtle performance as a genie who raps and finds the joy in life in the gritty 90s world of New York? I mean, if you really analyze the film, which very few people do.
We're waiting for J.D. Duran to start Epic Film Guys Spotlight segment.
So, Nick, this is how it's going to work. This is how it's going to work. You guys are going to do...
I don't give a fuck.
Thank you, Gazorpazor Field.
No, enough with your stupid sound bites. For once, listen to your co-host.
No.
Shut up.
Dan, stop saying
that. I don't want to hear Dan Brennick either. Again, for like the 50th time today. You guys are going to do Sideways, and then I'll be on for Untouchables because I love that film so, so much. So be prepared.
Well, I don't, JD. And, I don't see JD on, unfortunately. And
I rewatched Untouchables recently, and I didn't like it as much.
All right. Well, let me go ahead. I'm just going to rush over into our spotlight segment. And the first film that we're going to talk about here is Sideways. Let me throw a trailer up. I did get a trailer for this. And we'll put it over in...
Let me show you how this
Don't
is done.
Let me sing.
Hold the glass up and examine the line against the light. You're looking for color and clarity. Now, stick your nose in it.
There's some strawberry.
Oh, there's just a flutter of like a nutty Edam cheese.
When do we drink it?
Now.
Mmm.
Are you chewing gum?
No.
Spit it out.
thanks for my last week of freedom.
We're gonna play some golf, eat some great food, and we're gonna send you off in style. It's gonna be great.
So we have JD prepared to come on for the review right now. Ooh, actually,
get him in here.
Yeah, I got him in there. I said I was getting him in here, Nick. I said I was getting him in
He's
here.
He's moving.
So there you go.
He's moving. He's coming, man.
Don't
Just
move.
Give him a second.
He can't see if you don't move. Oh, wait, this isn't Jurassic Park.
It's not like the Indominus where that thing can see you at every moment, no matter if you move or not.
Just click on JD. JD, if you just click on where it says on the air, it'll bring you right into the on the air channel.
Yeah. Why did you tell them that my novel was being published?
It sucks that I can't add people to channels. It's really annoying. Like, unless they actually are in one of the voice channels, I can't actually add them to a channel, which is annoying as hell.
Overall, Nick, though, this is a great experience. I feel like for having a lot of different people on the show at the same time, it's worked way better than anything we've done previously.
I mean, I've watched a lot of this and throughout the day, and I mean, it's worked fantastically. It's actually gone really smooth throughout the day.
I feel like most of the problems we've had are YouTube related, actually.
Mostly.
All right, we're still working on getting JD in here. It really.
Well, what about how fucking there pretentious we got him in on the air. Is, man?
JD hey. On the air.
There I'm here. Go. Can you hear me?
Yes,
there
we
go.
JD from All the right. In Session Film Podcast is joining us. And of course, we do have John from the Now in Technicolor Podcast with us as well. Welcome, gentlemen. And I just spun the trailer for Sideways. So let's go ahead and open the salvos. And JD, since you're just fresh in, getting in here, I'm going to kick it to you first.
Well, right there, because I just put the kid down to bed, so I am now scrambling to join you fellas. First of all, I'm glad to be here, so thanks for inviting me.
Thank you for being here.
So glad to get you on so quick. You were like on point, man, so...
wrestling real hard to get the kid to bed so I could be here on time. So first of all, before I get into Sideways, let me just say I'm a big fan of Alexander Payne as a director. I feel like he doesn't get talked about
fucking lootly.
I really, really, really dig his stuff. So and Sideways is a movie that I really, really like. Paul Giamatti, Thomas Hayden Church is wonderful. I love their chemistry in this film. They obviously play these characters that are goofballs in a lot of ways, but the film is very aware of that and plays with that wonderfully throughout the film. So, Paul Giamatti he's an actor that, I guess in the same vein as what I was saying about Alexander Payne. I mean, I love this guy, and I'd love to see him carry more films.
He's great. He's pretty much everything I've ever seen him in, actually.
He's got a presence to him that I always enjoy, except maybe The Amazing Spider-Man 2, but that's another story for another time. But, yeah, he's wonderful. This is such... Yeah, it's such a wonderful, charming film. I don't think it's perfect. I think there are some screenplay issues here and there that keep me from loving the film. But overall, Sideways, man, it's a film that I think deserved all the recognition it got when it came out.
All right, and John, why don't we go ahead and move over to you? And yes, your thoughts on Sideways.
All right, well, I mean, I actually really enjoyed it. Like he was saying, Paul Giamatti is great. Really enjoy him. And then Thomas Church throughout the entire movie is really enjoyable. I mean, the two characters, like contrasting personalities all the way through it, are just amazing. It's well done. And I really enjoyed it. I mean, like I say, the way that Thomas Church's character is such a greaseball. He's like this aging has-been actor that's kind of slightly a greaseball through the whole thing. And then Paul Giamatti is like this pretentious kind of asshole. You know, he's very much uptight and stuck up. And he has a problem with everything. Mm-hmm. And like, I mean, admittedly, he's right through the entire thing about that. But I mean, he really should just kind of let go of his problems. And then the whole story just plays out kind of really hilariously. And the way it ends, I thought was really good, especially with the fact of the whole thing with him being a writer and the way the kind of they describe the way the story ends and then the way the movie ends. Yeah. I thought the way that kind of played out was well done. So, I mean, I really enjoyed it. And yeah, I mean, it's something that everybody should kind of check out.
All right. Well, okay. I want to drop this on JD right there.
Sorry.
He did mention some screenplay issues, and I'll be that guy that I don't give a shit how flawed the screenplay is for this movie. The characters in this film, even though Paul Giamatti's character and Thomas Hayden Church's character are reprehensible characters, Paul Giamatti maybe a little bit less so, but if only because, I mean, Jack kind of browbeats him into this, I'm going to get laid on my last week of freedom and you're going to like it. And Paul Giamatti's just such a, he's such a little feeble weakling of a character. He just basically lets Paul Giamatti steamroll over him. But then he's also just this colossal asshole at the same time.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
they're both so reprehensible, and you have the wonderful, wonderful characters by Virginia Madsen and Sandra Oh, who are absolutely fantastic, who just have the misfortune, I think, of running across these guys. But these four characters, these are some of, and going back to, as JD said about Alexander Payne, he doesn't get talked about enough, and these are the kinds of characters that he creates in his films. They are so engrossing. You cannot help but just get swept up in whatever story they're a part of, even if you find them detestable, and that's what I love so much about this movie.
What I was saying about the screenplay, like the issues that I have of the screenplay are minor in the grand scheme of things. I mean, it's the difference in what keeps me from truly loving this is some of Alexander Payne's best work and something that I just find really, really good in execution. And I agree with you guys. I think these characters are incredibly engrossing. And going back to the performances of this film, you know, what I like so much about the Miles character, even though he is a bit pretentious and he has some abrasive qualities to him, the thing about Giamatti's performance as well as the screenplay, it allows for you to sympathize with him, because he's a guy that, while he does have a stuck-up nature to him to a degree, most of those abrasive qualities are rooted in the guy and the fact that the guy's just hurting. You know, he's recently divorced. He hasn't been able to get over that relationship. And you know, I think for any of us that have been in that position, we can sympathize with, you know, his downfall, so to speak. So, and then when you juxtapose that with the Jack character, who's on this last, you know, binge, and he's out to get laid and has a more upbeat and happy quality to him, the way those two characters rub up against one another is just it's incredible to watch in this film.
Yeah, he's absolutely, I definitely agree, where I you know, who hasn't been there, you know, in terms of, you know, he's obviously still devastated over the end of his marriage, which, if you pay attention to the plot, is actually his fault because he has an affair. And, you know, it's obviously something that he realized how much of a colossal mistake he made. He's devastated by the fact that, you know, they're divorced, and then he finds out she's remarried and that she's coming to the wedding. And they have that whole scene.
He lashes
out at Jack when he tells him about it. And then they have that whole scene where he grabs the bottle of wine and he runs down the hill toward the vineyard, chugging wine out of the bottle and everything.
Great.
My heart absolutely breaks for this character. Like when he makes the drunken phone call at the restaurant, like you could tell that this is something that utterly haunts this character. He's so broken by this. And why I love Miles' character the most out of all the characters in this film, especially because I can relate to him the most in that sense. But it's also why, like, at the same time, he's got Jack as a best friend who, you know, some people don't understand how their friendship works or don't understand why they're friends just because they're pretty different people altogether. But I mean, I've got friends like that are completely different people from who I am.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really not make any sense to me. But at the same time, like, I'm not the kind of person that would be the total pushover like Miles is, where he's just so wrapped up in his own depression that he just doesn't care, enough about what Jack is doing. And then he seems incredulous when, you know, Maya's upset with him about, you know, the fact that he kept this from her. And, you know, she has that moment in the car when they're driving back from the picnic after he accidentally tells her, you know, where, you know, he's whatever. And he's like, oh, I was on the verge of telling you last night. And she's like, but you wanted to fuck me first, right? And it's like, when you watch that scene, it's like, I think Miles just has just a little bit of Jack in him. Just a little bit. And
yeah.
I love these characters, but I hate them.
You love to hate them. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, and just in the, you know, in the middle of all of this conflict and drama, there are just scenes that stand out as hilarious as we see these characters unravel. I mean, you mentioned the scene where he's running down the hill, which is great. There's the scene where Miles loses it in the winery and he just takes that whole bucket or whatever, just dumps it all over his head.
Spit bucket.
Yeah, exactly. It's a
spit bucket for the wine where they're like, we're drinking it, and then they dump it out into the actual, little bucket there. And since he got pissed, I mean, he got fucking pissed, man. Like, he, took the bottle, and he was like, no, fuck that. He dumped it all over himself, so he just grabbed it and dumped it all down his mouth, but he didn't actually drink any of it.
Oh,
he just dumped
God.
It down himself. You actually notice he just pours it down his face.
I love that it's kind of a two-front. It's kind of a two-front thing for Miles's character at that point, because you know that they're at a winery that he absolutely and utterly detests. He calls, what does he call it? Fucking Raid. I think he calls the wine when they're tasting Raid. It. So he hates the wine, but he's so upset.
He's like, they crushed up
mice. Like, I think mice and shit.
He was like, everything that was with the fucking grapes. He was like, they just threw it all in there, crushed it up, and fucking made this Raid ass fucking drink.
I love
that. And more so than the act of dumping the spit bucket on him, what I find interesting about that scene is actually a few moments before that, because earlier in the film they established that Miles is very knowledgeable when it comes to wine, and he's very by the book as far as how you treat it. He there's a respect that he has to how you're supposed to do it. And then he goes up to the bar, and what does he do? He treats it like a shot. He treats it like liquor, like it's something that you could just toss away. It is so against his nature. And I think that moment specifically speaks to the moment more so than the catharsis he has. Yeah, but even the dumping of that is still hilarious to watch.
Oh, my God. I mean, to even add more to the layers of Miles' character, I mean, think about what this entire week for him represents. It represents a week for him to let loose and kind of forget about his normal life and just spend a week with his best friend. But what happens when they're there? First, he finds out that his best friend's been talking to his ex-wife behind his back, and that she's remarried, and that she's coming to the wedding and bringing her new husband. Then his best friend shacks up with this other girl and just abandons him for, like, literally he's alone for like 3 days, or like 2 or 3 days on his trip, where it's he's like
3 days.
He's clipping his nails in the room, and then he goes and buys a fucking Hustler, and he's grading papers in a hot tub at the hotel. It's like, this is clearly not what he wanted at all from this trip, and it just kind of adds further to the descent of this character. And that's what's when he finally gets the news that his book deal fell through. It's the last nail in that coffin, where he just utterly breaks, you know, completely. And, you know, it leads into the end of the movie. And it oh my God, the end of this movie where you have Mr. Friendly from Lost. they go to the steakhouse, and he meets, you know, Thomas Hayden Church's character meets the waitress, and he's like, oh, I'm going to go back to her and make sure she gets home safe. And he's so incredulous about it. And she takes him back, and then he shows up naked at the door the next morning. And he's like, you got to go get back and get it. And he goes in, and he sneaks in, and he steals the rings. And then he comes chasing him out the door.
Worst part of the movie.
Buck naked.
Worst part of the movie.
Yeah. Oh, my God. It's so, so funny.
What did I miss?
I missed the worst part of the movie.
We're talking about dicks, Justin. It's your favorite thing.
Swinging meat.
Hey, I saw something last week that might have been something that could be considered that. I don't know if you want to call it that or not. It looked like a giant Italian sausage, and I saw it outside of the Ned Devine's bar.
My brain is breaking.
I see it every single other week where a male gentleman brings a female back behind the dumpster at that Ned Devine's bar that I like to hang out at right next to that McDonald's. And he likes to slip his thing right outside where everyone can see it.
Shut up! Jesus Christ, what the hell is wrong with you? Please, just shut up!
Good work.
That is one of my favorite sound drops that I have on the soundboard. Yes,
I don't know what those things are. I don't even know what that noise is that you're making there. Nick, how are you? What am I a part of here? Justin went into the bedroom to take care of his dogs.
JD's not used to being on the show with this much cursing. Everybody class it the fuck up. Shut up.
Hey, Justin told me when he had shots last week on Sunday that he talked to those guys at the In Session Film Podcast and they both cursed a couple of times at least. They did say some naughty words, I remember, because I was listening to them talk.
Yeah. Oh my God. But yeah, they were said.
I can't. Oh. Fix yourself! There we go. That's all he gets. So, just to wrap up our thoughts about Sideways, because we got to move on to the Untouchables here for just a moment. But I absolutely love this movie. Alexander Payne, of course, I probably have more of a soft spot for him than most. He did direct my favorite movie of all time, which is about Schmidt. But when I saw this movie, my expectations were extremely high because this was his follow-up to that and absolutely blew me out of the water. I absolutely love it. I love the characters in it, as detestable as I find them. And I love wine. So just the fact that they're talking about wine, even though I am nowhere near as pretentious as Miles, even though coincidentally, I also fucking hate Merlot, cannot stand it. It's just, it is never, ever, I've had like one good Merlot in my life. Like when we go to wineries up in the Finger Lakes to taste wine, I avoid them like the plague. I can't stand them. But I love this movie. So man, I'll swing around to everybody else for final thoughts and then we'll move on to the Untouchables.
And start. I really love this film, as we've been talking about. Alexander Payne, great director, really good writing. The performances here are fantastic. And look out for.
Thank you very much, Patrick, for your donation. Thank you.
You know he's donating for the Hopester, right? So
God damn it! Donate more for the Hopester. The Hopester needs money to get boozed on. I'm sorry, JD, as you were saying, thank you.
The last thing I'll just say about Alexander Payne, he's got a new movie coming out later this year called Downsizing. It looks spectacular, so keep that on your radar.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I mean, I kind of pretty much said it already. The performances were great. I really enjoyed the way the characters were so against the grain against each other, and just the overall story was kind of amazing. And although it ends on a cliff note, I thought it was really great. So it's kind of
all right. Well, we will go ahead and we're going to push right on here over to the Untouchables. I'll go ahead and I'll spin a little trailer here for everybody.
I grew up in a tough neighborhood. Sometimes reputation follows you.
Robert De Niro is Al Capone.
There it is.
There's violence in Chicago, of course, but not by me and not by anybody I employ. And I'll tell you why, because it's not good business.
Kevin Costner is Elliot Ness.
I have sworn to put this man away with any and all legal means at my disposal, and I will do so.
Sean Connery is Jimmy Malone.
You want to get Capone? Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
You just joined the Treasury Department, son. Everybody knows where the booze is. The problem isn't finding it.
Let's do some good!
The problem is who wants to cross the pond.
Somebody messes with me, I'm gonna mess with him.
You carry a badge?
Yes.
Carry a gun.
Get your hands in the air!
You're all under arrest. So, Brian De Palma's The Untouchables, which, to borrow a term from the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews podcast, this was De Palma before he, quote, De Palma'd. if you will. This one actually was a first time watch for me yesterday. I actually had never seen this film before yesterday. I just had the chance to check this out, but I want to get around the panel here, and I'll start with you, John. Just opening thoughts on The Untouchables.
Opening thoughts. I really think this is a great film. Like, really, I've watched it many times over the years, and I actually watched it not too long ago, actually getting ready for this, and I still enjoyed it. I think it was one of the better Kevin Costner roles, and Sam and Sean Connery's character is freaking awesome. I love him from the moment you first meet him, when he's walking down the beat and he's just like giving Kevin Costner's character shit, and then when he asked him a question, he's like, what am I supposed to do, teach you how to be a cop? You're supposed to learn that on day one. So I mean, and the way it all plays out with Capone and De Niro, it's amazing. I love it. I mean, I really enjoy it, and I kind of want to move. Started running out of things to say for a second because I was like overthinking myself. But yeah, no, like the whole thing is though that Andy Garcia, when you meet him, is great. And like the moment the FBI accountant, I can't remember his actual name right this moment, when he comes in, he actually gets the shotgun, he starts loving it, and then he actually dies. That's a hard moment, because that's when like they find out they're completely touchable and the group kind of starts falling apart. And when the whole story like gets to the end, I mean, there's a hell of an impact.
Oh my god, I absolutely agree. There was a few scenes in this film, and I definitely had some issues with it. And since I'm watching it, 30 years removed now from its original release, I probably have a little bit of a different opinion on it than most do, especially when it comes to De Niro as Al Capone. But I'll swing over to you, JD, to start on this one.
Okay, well, I am in a slightly different camp there, and I hate to be the Debbie Downer of this particular discussion, but here's the thing. I like The Untouchables. I think it's a fine movie. I don't think it's anything more than that. For me, The Untouchables suffers from significant narrative issues, especially the way it interweaves Al Capone. I feel like it doesn't, for me, it doesn't give a glimmer of what makes the man tick or why he does what he does. I feel like they're just kind of thrown in there randomly to kind of, you know, add stakes or add drama. But to me, there isn't a rhythm to the film. And part of that is in the screenplay. And I think part of that is also in De Palma's direction. The editing and the pacing of the movie just doesn't make sense to me at all in certain parts. I think the idea of this group coming together and to, you know, stifle this rampant corruption in Chicago, the idea on paper is great. And I do like Costner. I think Sean Connery is actually really great in the film. But it's hard for me to engage with the film dramatically because of those narrative and direction issues I've been talking about. So, for me, it's a decent watch. It's one that I would still recommend, but it's nothing special to me.
Yeah, I'm actually going to jump right off of that, JD. When I watch the film, I think it's got some really great set pieces. It's got some really, really great setups where, you know, you see like when Sean Connery's character is killed. I really think that whole scene is fantastic. I think that he kind of builds up the tension in that well. But that's the problem. This film's kind of all about the money shots for me. Outside of those those scenes that really kind of, you know, you're transfixed on the screen. There's also those scenes, and I know I'm probably going to get shit for this, but I don't care. Like, the final shootout in the train station or whatever it is with the baby carriage. Like, there's so many lingering fucking shots on that kid in the baby carriage. I wanted to scream. I'm like, Jesus, yeah. God damn it. Stop showing me the fucking kid. I don't care.
But they wanted you to remember that baby was there. Oh, never forget the baby.
Jesus. Like, it was egregious. Like, people fucking bitch about Zack Snyder loving slow-mo and shit. Oh, my God. It's just like the egregious shot after shot after shot of the baby and the damn thing. It's like, okay, we get it. There's a baby. Oh my God. But like, to go back to what I was going to say about De Niro, I think he's fantastic as Al Capone for the minute and a half of screen time he actually gets in the film. He's barely in the fucking movie. He's barely fucking in it.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I was so frustrated.
More than a minute.
Well, it's a little more than a, okay, fine. I'm being a little bit, you know.
Who recommended this film, by the way? Who recommended this?
I don't remember who recommended the first spotlight, but
I think the entire
thing like, I
think the entire thing kind of relies on everyone knowing the general story of Al Capone already when you go into it. I think it like that's the reason there's not a lot of like actual lingering setup with the characters, is they're already expecting you to know. The general backstory of this character and everything. And I feel like that's a little bit of a cop out.
It is.
But,
yeah, it's lazy.
I mean, just no, I guess knowing that, I didn't find a lot of fault with it when I originally watched it and still kind of don't. But I mean, yeah, I mean, for the general audience viewer, that's probably not a great idea.
Well,
if you go into it and just because you have to have characters set up with people, because I mean the general idea is that you don't actually need to rely on the fact that this person actually knows what the backstory is, unless it's Spider-Man. You know, then everyone knows the fucking backstory, and no one needs to know.
Hold up. Please for a second. I absolutely adore this film. Brian De Palma's direction in the film is absolutely perfect for a gangster flick in the 80s. And it shows, if you watch the film, it is definitely an 80s centric film. Put that thing in your mouth, Nick. I'm going to punch it right down your fucking throat. What a dick. I'm going to take that thing. I'm going to shove it so far down. You're going to be choking. And hearing Dan's voice makes me even more aggravated to want to punch it even further down.
It does aggravate everybody.
It does. I love everybody, but I don't care about the faults of this movie. I don't give a shit. I grew up watching this movie, and I feel like it's the best depiction of Al Capone that's on the big screen that we've ever seen, only because of the simple fact that I feel like even though De Niro was not the one they wanted, people didn't want De Niro cast. He was the one that was like against the grain. I feel like he did a fantastic job of portraying at least who the character was of Al Capone as we knew him in the public eye, of being that kind of like very lovable public persona, but in the back of the room kind of situation, very dark and violent person. And we do get enough of him to get a fixture on that character. He's not supposed to be the main front of the film. It's called The Untouchables. And I love that there's that mystery of the Al Capone character in the film. And one of the standouts in this movie, outside of Sean Connery, is, and this is one of his breakout performances, I absolutely love him. And all, out of all the 80s films that have come out, Brian De Palma had a certain sensibility that he took when he got behind the camera. And he took that kind of halfway sleaze that he has with him on a lot of films that he did, even including Scarface when he made this movie. So I absolutely love it. And I love how brutal it is. And it's relentless in its action sequences. And you guys all mentioned that whole stair sequence with the baby and the slow-mo. Dude, nothing was done like that during that time. So you guys can mention Zack Snyder. You can mention all these modern homeboys making movies now. Nothing had been done like that up until that point with that super, super slow-mo. It was super stylized for the time, but it took audiences by chance. And they were like, whoa, we've never seen anything like this before. It's so silent. There's very little, there's no dialogue. There's just an emotion to the situation, and it's fantastic, and I absolutely adore it. And that's why I love The Untouchables. I think it's one of the best gangster flicks of the 80s because of the simple fact that Brian De Palma has a handle on the material. Is it an amazing film?
No.
I would have to take a step back and say it's not one of his best, but it's still a great, well-directed film, especially for the gangster genre.
I mean, I think that's very fair, Justin, and I respect what you're saying. And for me, it's less so much the execution of the stylization in the film as much as the film overall is more concerned with that style than it is substance. And for me,
which was the 80s.
I mean, it's the 80s. Yeah,
absolutely. And again, that is certainly fair, but there are even films in the 80s that I feel like were able to bring a balance of both. And while the film doesn't necessarily have a finger on the Al Capone character, my big problem with the is that when De Palma decides to bring Capone onto the screen, he feels like there has to be weight to it, and it feels like the film is concerned about it, but only in those particular moments. And the way he interweaves that throughout the film, it just feels somewhat cheap in the long run. And I would have appreciated perhaps a little bit more insight into what made him tick, even if we weren't gonna. You don't necessarily have to expand on or give us exposition on the character,
let's talk about something that's great about this movie. Let's talk about something fantastic about this movie. Ennio Morricone's score to the film. What do you guys think about the score?
I like the score. Sure.
Yeah, the score is enjoyable.
Oh, come on. You guys sound like it's not that great. I mean, seriously, think about that score. When this film opens, that's an iconic score for this film. We don't get scores like that anymore.
Well,
and Sean Connery won an Oscar for this film. Sean Connery won Best Actor in a Supporting Role. I feel like it's one of the best performances of his career because he was an older guy when he made the movie, and he put so much effort into this performance, and it's such a great cast of the movie. I mean, dumbing down how great the film is outside of its narrative aspect.
Well, and like I said in my initial thoughts, I wouldn't go as far as to say the film is bad, and I said I would recommend the movie. I just don't think it's anything truly special or anything truly great. It's fun. It lives in its stylization. It wheels it on its sleeve.
Fantastic, right?
Yeah, the aesthetics are wonderful throughout the film. Absolutely, no doubt about that. But it's just a stifling experience dramatically, and that's what keeps me from fully engaging with it.
Well, when is the first time you guys have both seen this film?
Mm-hmm. Well, Nick said it was the first time he had seen it. Like,
I'm not asking Nick. I'm asking our guests. You guys.
I've seen it I saw it years ago. I mean, I saw it back probably when I was about 10 years old was the first time I actually saw the movie.
Yeah, I had seen it a while ago as well. It was a film that my dad really liked. So I definitely saw it when I was a kid. And I did rewatch it. In preparation for this.
Yeah, I did too. But there was actually something I wanted to comment about JD when he was saying with the storyline and kind of wanting a little bit more about Capone and the way he ticks. I mean, I don't know if that's essential to the actual storyline, though, because the story is about them trying to get Capone, not necessarily about Al Capone himself.
He's like the backstory.
So they are kind of just giving you a backstory with him. He's really, like Justin actually pointed out, like it's all about the public eye with Capone.
Yeah, but my counter argument to that, though, is when Capone comes on the screen, there are times where De Palma goes out of his way to show us why people are afraid of him or why he's this mythical figure. If either commit to giving us some more of Capone, or you can just completely write him out of the film and let him be a mythical figure and focus on the Untouchables themselves. I feel like De Palma wanted to have his cake and eat it too, and it just doesn't work here for me.
I feel like what makes it that way is because of the simple fact that De Niro was such a bankable name at that point, especially for gangster pictures, that they knew they had something there as far as box office was concerned and major audiences, where they knew they could just run with it and it would work, and it definitely worked. I mean, the film was highly successful. Major audiences adored the film. While we're talking about the film, and Nick included there because he's sitting there smoking his vape, looking like he's as angry as possible. Kevin Costner is Elliot Ness. This is one of his biggest roles up until that point. This is one of his biggest performances. no one wanted him for this role, mind you, and he got into this role by luck. We'll start with you, JD. What did you think of Kevin Costner's Elliot Ness in the film? And then we'll move on to Nick.
I don't have a problem with any of the performances, honestly. I think Costner is fine. He's an engaging presence, and I find him compelling in this film. I mean, Sean Connery is the standout. I do think he deserved the award that he got. But yeah, I mean, I liked him, and I liked his chemistry with Connery.
Back here.
He was super good.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, I know Nick loves Costner for Robin Hood, Men of Thieves, the best, but...
Oh, yeah. Sure.
There you go.
Because he doesn't have the ability to do a British accent. It's enjoyable. Man.
Come on. Where is Nick's anecdotes now? Come on, damn it. When I press him, he doesn't have anything.
I mean, he's no Hidden Figures, Costner.
No Field of Dreams.
Yeah. No Draft Day, Costner.
I'm sure he loves Waterworld.
This was the first of his breakout roles. I mean, this was the film that kind of set him off, if I recall, to being a big box office name. The film was pretty big, not only in theaters, but on cable and on home video. Everyone really, really enjoyed this film, not only as a gangster picture, but as just, you know, basic entertainment for.
Oh, yeah. I think it serves that function
well.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel like the character was actually really compelling, as you said earlier, but that he did a really good job. That it's just that him next to Sean Connery there in this film, I mean, I feel like he was the secondary character a lot of times in the scenes. But I mean, overall he did a great job, and he was very deserving of like this kind of starting his career off.
Yeah. So as we're finishing this off, guys, it sounds as though there's a collective opinion here that Robert De Niro was not a good Al Capone. So I just want to hear your opinions before we finish up on this as to why you think he was or he wasn't a good Al Capone. And then we will move on to...
I just want to jump in on it.
There he is.
I think he was a fantastic Al Capone. And I get what you're saying. The film is called The Untouchables. It's more about Costner and the crew. I get it, but I like the scene with the baseball bat, and this is one of those things where I'm a huge Simpsons fan, so I get to watch things after the fact that I've seen parodied on The Simpsons 1,000 times, so I never understood what that parody was about. But like the scene where he bashes the dude's head in with the baseball bat, and you get to see how menacing it. I just wanted more of his character. I thought that De Niro was fantastic in the role. I just wanted more of it.
I can relate to that so much. I started watching it earlier because I do own it, and because we knew we were talking about this. By the way, Nick does like to throw things at me last minute, even though I should be planning better. But the simple fact is I knew we were going to be talking about it tonight, so I wanted to rewatch it again as of today before we talked about it tonight, because movies of that era, especially by Brian De Palma, who no longer makes movies. And if you guys have not seen that documentary that's out right now called De Palma, I highly recommend it. He does touch on a lot of thoughts on how he made this movie and a lot of ideas behind this movie, among other movies he had done. Dressed to Kill, Scarface, you name Mission Impossible 1. Check that documentary out. It's called De Palma. But I love this movie so much. I can't help it. It is a period piece in the 80s, and very rarely do period pieces in the 80s get it as well as De Palma did in this film. I mean, we're looking at that GIF that I picked that's right in our live stream right now. And look at Costner and Connery right there. Look at that shot. Do we ever get shots that are that good anymore? I mean, it may be popcorn fluff to a lot, and I totally get that. But at the time, that's really what people went to the theaters to see. So for me, that's why I love this film so much.
Yeah, definitely agree, right, man. Definitely agree.
Yeah. It is fun. I mean, it's definitely, like I said, it's a movie I would recommend. It's No Man Next to Your Road, but it's good. It's fine.
Oh, of course. Well, let me... Hey, man, I don't think anyone's comparing anything to Mad Max Fury Road on that.
I'm with Shane on that one. I'm with Shane on that one with the Mad Max.
Get out.
I can't help it.
Get out.
Yes. Oh, yep. You have to get out now, too. You're not welcome. I'm just kidding. I won't be as angry about that. I mean, the cool thing about this whole experience of doing the Movie Pod Squad or any kind of podcasting together with other movie podcasts is getting differing opinions on everything. And that's the fun of it. If we all agreed on everything, how fun would it be to talk about the movies? It'd be no fun at all. I love it. You love it. Great performances. All right. You know, the whole point is to try to get a opinion into it and see where we're coming from. And I love that personal experience so much. And that's why I'm glad we've had you guys on here for the Untouchables review. And I'm glad I got to be a part of it. Definitely. Because Nick lets me, you know, be a part of such a small part of the Epic Film Guys podcast.
You get back over in your corner and keep quiet.
This small little not even 25 minute segment on the show.
You get back over in your corner. You got, keep quiet.
You were the Capone all in this good fun, segment.
All in good fun.
You go pet your goddamn hamster. All right. So, yeah, that's going to be our spotlight reviews again for Sideways and the Untouchables. Yeah, I did enjoy the Untouchables. I won't say I didn't enjoy it. And it definitely had its moments. It had some great parts about it that I loved. You know, some great spectacle to it, but I, like I said, I think I wanted more out of it, and it's one of those things where I've had this experience so many times where when you go back to a film that's this old that you're not experiencing in its time, where it just doesn't have the same effect on you that it did if you experienced it in its time. So I'll definitely say that about it, because I know that there's many other films that are like that for me. This has been a production of the Podfix Network. For more great content like this, get your fix at podfixnetwork.com.